chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got quite a program going this evening, and we've got just two main issues here and topics we're going to cover. The first part of the program, we're going to cover the Wuhan Lab, The Truth About Wuhan, by Andrew G. Huff. It's a brand new book out, and Alex interviewed him, and I've got two clips there. One is short, and the other one is extended, but we need to listen to both of these. Mr. Huff was involved with those same organizations that Fauci was involved with, and he has great insight. So here's a clip of Andrew J. Huff, and then we're going to follow an extended interview that he had with Alex.
We're back with a Fox News alert, part three of the Twitter files, revealing executives met with the FBI and DHS and DNI on a weekly basis around the 2020 election.
Weekly basis. In a series of tweets, Matt Taibbi writes, policy director Nick Pickles is asked if the marketing department should say Twitter detects misinformation through human review and partnerships with outside experts.
Yeah, so Pickles told them to say partnerships. Not sure we'd describe the FBI and DHS as experts, reads the quote.
Sounds right.
Whatever it is, they're looking for some way to characterize their relationship with law enforcement. And Unfiltered's Dan Bongino is a great place to start in characterizing that relationship. As we learned this week, Dan, you were one of the people placed on Twitter's blacklist to their search engine. Good morning, Dan. How would you characterize that relationship?
Listen, this is only the biggest First Amendment scandal of my lifetime. I just turned 48 not that long ago. I've never seen, and here's the crazy thing, guys. It's so easy to explain that it's hilarious watching liberal media activists, you know, wet their diapers trying to defend this. First, remember the story over the Twitter government collusion to suppress people like me and shadow ban me? The first story was, well, listen, it's a private company. They can do what they want. There's really no government involvement. And then we found out that there was government involvement, that the FBI may have been involved. And then we were confirmed that the FBI was involved. And then they were like, well, the FBI was just giving general warnings to tech companies. And then it turned out that it was the FBI and the DNI and the DHS and potentially the CDC and others. And then they were like, okay, it was just a lot of general warnings from the government. And then, sorry, one more, guys. Then the story morphed again. The Yoel Roth Twitter executive sworn statement to the FEC came out where he admitted that it wasn't a general warning, but that these entities had warned specifically about the Hunter Biden story. And now all of a sudden they're like, well, screw it. We're just commies. Let's just admit it and cut the BS. I mean, really, wait, this is the guys. Can anyone on the couch? I know you're all strong, liberty loving patriots. Can anyone explain to me how the FBI, the DNI, and the DHS meeting with a private company and winking and nodding, suggesting they restrict people's free speech? Can you please explain to me how that's not a violation of the First Amendment? I'm all ears, man. It's unbelievable we're even having this debate.
Well, but Dan, the media is ignoring it. You know, outside of us, we're covering it, but the media is ignoring it. You know, as we learn more, how deep do you think this goes, Dan?
Well, listen, this is the next shoe to drop here. So on my show tonight, I have an unfiltered about, it was supposed to be an 8-minute monologue. I think Pete may have heard some of it. I've interviewed Pete tonight as well. He's always awesome. But it was supposed to be 8. It turned into like a 13-minute monologue. It's completely unscripted. And it really screwed up my whole show because we almost had to cancel some guests, not Peter. But I produced the receipts and the facts tonight. that it's not just that they colluded with the government to restrict free speech. We know that. Media imbeciles, we're not arguing about that. Just sit in the corner and shut up. We get all that. You guys are just useless anyway. We'll take this from here. The next shoe to drop is, were these tech companies colluding with each other? And I'll tell you why I bring this up. And I produced the receipts tonight on my show. Mm-hmm. You know, I was attacked at the... But I don't want to be dramatic. I was confronted by a lot of these tech companies, let's say, all around the same time on my podcast and everywhere else. And they all seem to have the same message. Now, I can't prove they were colluding with each other, but I'll show you tonight how Google, how YouTube, which is part of Google, Facebook and Twitter, all in this same time period, all came after little old Dan Bongino from Queens. YouTube banned me for saying that cloth masks don't stop the spread of COVID, which now, by the way, is scientific fact. Google ads wiped my website off their network. This is all around the same time Twitter suspended me after January 6th for simply retweeting Trump's statement.
Yeah.
And then Facebook says at the same time, oh, we're going to start crushing political content. And who is it going to affect? I even show you the news media piece. It says Ben Shapiro and Dan Bongino, because we have the biggest Facebook pages in the conservative space. Were they colluding with each other? That's the next shoe to drop. I think they were.
Go ahead. If I could, you know, I was thinking about Dan's question to us, and I wanted to engage.
I was too.
Of how they say it's not a First Amendment violation, like that question, Dan. And you know, like you, Dan, I love debating, right? So that means I go seek out the other side. How are they saying it? Increasingly in this story, how are they spinning it? I'll tell you what they're saying, Dan. Other than it's a nothing burger, there's the way they're saying this isn't a First Amendment violation is they're saying, well, the FBI can make recommendations to private companies. They can make recommendations on what they believe is disinformation. And then I think we move to the next step, which is, but if all of the recommendations flow in one direction, what does that tell us about our national intelligence apparatus, right? FBI, DHS, DNI, what does that tell us about those organizations, which we increasingly focus on and need to, and their point of view when it comes to someone like you, somebody like me, somebody Pete or Lisa, and our points of view?
You're a lawyer, so you'll get this probably better than most. I'm not, but I'm intimately familiar with how the law works, having spent my career in law enforcement. The law, and the reason we have judges, because as you know, Will, the law is a lot of gray area.
Right.
So, yes, they could technically say, oh, we just winked and nodded at Twitter and said, hey, this tweet Dan Bongino put out there about masks, you know, this could be classified as misinformation. You know, be a real shame if your place burned down if you didn't do anything about it, right?
Right.
And then the FBI can sit back and say, we didn't demand anything and play kind of a euphemisms game. But, Will, as an attorney, you know this. No judge is going to take that seriously. There's an implied force mechanism with government that doesn't exist when a private entity does that. The government is the only entity in the United States, in our country, that has the power to take your life and your freedom. We don't have mercenaries. We don't have a private police that are deputized by the government. You may have some kind of police powers, but the government sanctions that all the time. So when the FBI makes a recommendation, it's not a recommendation. It's an implied, you better do this or else. And any serious judge knows that. You know, the liberals
by the way,
listening,
Dan, I'm sorry. Really, this was happening at the same time, by the way. Democratic politicians were threatening big tech. You remember that?
Openly.
Democratic politicians were threatening big tech while the law enforcement arms were
openly
making suggestions.
Well, I was an investor, early investor in Parler. AOC literally tweeted out to Amazon about their cloud, which Parler was on. Hey, Amazon, what are you guys going to do about Parler? I mean, are you now again to the libs? I know you're not that bright, but let's reverse this a bit. They don't get it unless it kicks them in the teeth. Imagine you had said something like to the pro-abortion crowd on the left that the FBI went into a, say, pro-life group and said, hey, guys, you know, we're not recommending you block an abortion clinic. But, you know, if you did it, we may not do anything about it. So, you know, if you guys go and block, they would lose their minds. They would lose their minds.
But
they don't, you know.
It all always goes in the direction of hurting Republicans.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
You know what I mean?
It's Democrats in Washington, D.C. with a lot of power, winking and nodding at Democrats in San Francisco
all
with a lot of power, all flowing in one particular direction. And they never counted on any of us knowing because it's an elite government agency and a Silicon Valley company that wasn't supposed to be bought by Elon Musk. Instead, we learned that guys like you were targeted. Dan, real quick, on your show tonight, what do you got?
I got Pete Hegseth, Charlie Kirk, Byron Donalds, Charlie Hurt. I got a killer monologue. And Pete gets to judge who did it better in karaoke.
Uh-oh.
Brett Baer,
okay,
or Hillary Clinton. Yes, it's probably the best segment
be
on the show. Yes,
I saw the Hillary Clinton thing, and I will never. I wanted to like pound my head against.
Yeah,
we
all
bad
did.
Against
we
the
all
wall.
Did.
Brett
Baer,
surprising
like
skills.
Oh,
is that
really?
Right? Yeah, you got to watch him.
Dan, good to see you.
Thanks,
Dan.
Brother.
Thanks, guys.
And now an extended interview with Andrew G. Hupp and Alex. Here we go next.
Ladies and gentlemen, this story couldn't be bigger. Please take notes and share it.
InfoWars, the most banned network in the world.
This is a real emergency, as Dr. Paul in the Senate has said. Anthony Fauci has been on record for decades running U.S. biological weapon operations under the guise of vaccine development. It's all come out in the documents. It's all come out because of whistleblowers, and he's lied to Congress. And he's told them that he's never been involved in any of it, even though he's hosted gain-of-function conferences. And it just broke 2 months ago that Boston University, also under his direction, has developed a weaponized COVID-19 that kills 80% of the humanized mice that come in contact, showing it would have a devastating effect on humans, being many, many times more dangerous for us than the first version. Now, obviously, it didn't escape from a lab very early on. Major universities scanned the virus. It could see how it had been combined and was artificial. And then we began to see information coming out from whistleblowers confirming that, indeed, Fauci, Daszak, and others have been quarterbacking the operation. Well, now we have one of those whistleblowers, well, the main whistleblower, on the broadcast. He has been through hell. And this information, again, could not be more important because, as Senator Paul and many others have said, any time now, another one of these similar man-made viruses could get out by accident or on purpose and wreak havoc in our civilization again, as we've just seen. So we're going to walk through the history of it, what really happened, and then what our expert guest believes is really going on and why this happened. The truth about Wuhan, how I uncovered the biggest lie in history. Dr. Andrew G. Hupp, former EcoHealth Alliance vice president and senior scientist. And that is the health alliance that was used as the front group by the Bill Gates money, by the Defense Department money, at Fauci's direction. And we've seen the emails come out. We've seen the evidence of this really in the last 2.5 years. And I would give about 90% of the credit. There's been some other major whistleblowers as well, but the real smoking guns from Dr. Andrew G. Hupp. And it's a whole other part of the story, the harassment they put him under. So, again, he would sound crazy when he talked about the harassment, similar things that they did to Hemingway and others. But we now know, thanks to all these data dumps from Twitter, thanks to Elon Musk, that there's been massive censorship and harassment going on, being coordinated by the Justice Department and the State Department. And that's who runs the CIA. Absolutely huge news. Congress has launched an investigation into the State Department funding of third parties to censor online speech and more. So when you hear State Department, that means the folks commanding the CIA. So he joins us to cover all of these issues. We had him on earlier in the week during the regular show, but we didn't have enough time with him. And I just want to impress upon listeners that you know most of the information you know about this thanks to Dr. Hupp. And now he's here to tell all at great risk to his life. He is a combat veteran and was trained at some of the top universities, including MIT. He went on again to be the senior scientist for this worldwide organization and worked in these labs around the world. So he is the insider, the thing they fear the most coming forward. Because he said earlier in the week, he didn't do this to be evil. There's a lot of folks working in the government that are great people. And as he saw corrupt bad things, he did what he was supposed to. He went to Congress, and then they came after him. So now he's come to the public. Skyhorse, the Great Patriots, that published my number one New York Times bestseller that they didn't give number one status to, but they admit was number one. The Great Reset and the War for the World have now published this book that should go to number one as well, The Truth About Wuhan, How I Uncovered the Biggest Lie in History. So Dr. Andrew G. Hupp, thank you so much for joining us for the next 50 minutes. I'm going to try to give you the floor as much as possible to walk through all this, and then what you think should be done to stop them allowing a leak or causing a leak or releasing a virus in the future for more power and control, and what we should do in the future as well to safeguard against these bioweapon programs masquerading as vaccine programs. So again, we salute you and thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And Alex, I think due to appearing on your show, the first production run of the book sold out in 3 days. So thank you so much for helping me get the message out. Without platforms like yours and the other people that helped me over the past 2 years, I don't think the message would have ever gotten out. So my story is unique as a scientist. I began my career actually in the military. I served as an infantryman in Operation Enduring Freedom in Central America and in Operation Iraqi Freedom during the height of the war in 2004 and 2005. I thought I was going to be a career officer, and I really had a change of heart after my second combat deployment. So I decided to focus on science. I thought I was going to be a psychologist first. My first degree was in psychology. I started managing mental health outpatient clinics for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Decided that I had a terrible bedside manner and I hated counseling. Bought some time, so I got a master's degree in engineering and security technology and geographic information systems. And my master's degree was heavily national security focused. So at the end of that program, I finished top of my class. My advisors, who were all sort of tied to the deep state, the national security complex, really impressed upon me that I should go on and get a PhD in public health, emerging infectious diseases, and specialize in bioterrorism and biowarfare. They said, go talk to this research center director, his name was Sean Kennedy, at the University of Minnesota, working at the National Center for Food Protection and Defense, which is a Department of Homeland Security Center of Excellence. I went over there, and they basically gave me a dream offer. I spoke with Sean, spoke with Dr. Jeff Bender, who was one of my advisors, and it was like, you know, a six-figure salary plus full scholarship plus having data handed me directly from the Department of Homeland Security. And because of my national security experience, my experience in the military, having a secret clearance, you know, not a top secret yet, but that really made me uniquely positioned to move upward quickly as part of this new biomedical security state. I became an expert in poisoning people through the food supply. So how can we cause mass casualty events? How can we kill 200, 300, 400,000 people in one event or one attack? So my research was really successful. I had all my research published within my first 2 years of my PhD, which is almost unheard of. And I went on to present this research at alphabet soup of government agencies, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, FDA, HHS. And then I started becoming a regular meeting attendee of different, what they're called, government coordinating councils for national security in different domains or areas of national security. So mainly public health and food and ag. Well, I made a lot of friends. My research was pioneering. Nobody outside the government really understood it, but when I completed this program, it made me uniquely positioned to accept any position that I wanted. I was being recruited into the State Department, which could have been the CIA. I didn't really understand that at the time. I was call it naive for being a smart person. And my advisors came to me and they asked me, you know, where would you like to work? And Colonel John Hoffman, who wrote on the back of my book cover, he was my mentor. He actually helped stand up the U.S. Department of Homeland Security Bioterror Division with Dr. Tom McGinn. So these are some people who are really well connected. And I had befriended two different scientists from the National Laboratory, Sandia National Laboratories, where they primarily make nuclear weapons, but they're involved in a lot of other national security research. Right, 80% is nuclear weapons, 20% are other things. And I thought these guys were the coolest guys in the world. They basically had Dr. Strangelove type jobs. When there were national security emergencies or disasters, they would be called upon to help solve these catastrophic problems with science and engineering skills. Oftentimes, though, there's not disasters happening, so they're working on other things. So I asked to be placed essentially at this company or this national laboratory. They were quite receptive to me wanting to go there. I went down there and I interviewed. It was actually one of the most difficult interviews of my life. But shortly thereafter, I had a job offer and I was relocating down to New Mexico. I worked at this laboratory for just short of a year. So it was interesting. Really quickly while I was working there rapidly, my work was being increasingly classified. And through that process, I was worried that I was going to be stuck at this national laboratory forever. So I had a top secret clearance. I was giving high level presentations to all the different government agencies on my areas of expertise. So pandemic preparedness, intentional contamination of the food supply, and bioterror and biowarfare. So all my work is increasingly getting classified. And as a scientist, if you ever want to leave, you cannot do that because you can't communicate the results of your work outside of that body. So I started looking for other work. And it only took me probably 3 or 4 days when I made that decision to come across an organization called Eco Health Alliance. So Eco Health Alliance on its web page had this really neat or interesting mission. So the way that it was described is that by engaging in conservation activities, they could reduce the risk of emerging infectious diseases and thereby epidemics and pandemics, which has some face validity to it. Anytime that you can reduce the exposure risk of people going into the environment and being exposed to new novel diseases, you decrease the risk that that pandemic or that initial outbreak will occur. So I thought that was exciting, is neat. They were looking for a senior scientist in data and technology. So they wanted somebody who had modeling and simulation skills. So that was, you know, that was one skill set that I had. Machine learning or also artificial intelligence. That was back in 2014 or 15. That was a hot growing field. I'd been working in that. We were just coming off using Markov chain models, which was the new latest hottest thing. And they also wanted someone who was an epidemiologist, had some lab skills. I mean, they wanted, basically their ask was for an impossible person or position. And I fit it exactly. So I was flown out to Eco Health Alliance. I interviewed, and I was offered the position within just a matter of a couple of days. This all went very quickly, and this is now we're in the fall of 2014, so September-ish. And so I moved out to New York City from New Mexico, and I begin the job, and I quickly learned that things are not quite like I was led to believe. So Eco Health Alliance is doing some defense work, and the department that I'm taking over has a failing defense contract. My predecessor left for similar reasons that I left to. His name's Dr. Nico Preston, and we can get back to that in a little bit. But so I begin working. I begin turning the department around. I'm successful at that. I bring in an additional $4.5 million within my first year. And to put that in perspective, so I'm in my early 30s at this point, and I've already brought in $6 million of money to a grungy granola type research organization, which is huge. I'm able to transform the office in terms of technology. So new office equipment, new computers, new systems, new cloud computing, all these things. I dramatically increased the size of my staff. Plus the work that I'm doing is high impact. So at that point I was developing, signals intelligence platforms, or which is also known by biosurveillance. So the idea is that how do we detect emerging infectious diseases? Like that diagram you just put up, the second that a person gets sick or an animal gets sick, how can you detect that? So we actually use digital disease detection methods. So you can take a lab sample, for example, from an animal and then put it into a computer. And when that information is transmitted, it now becomes a digital signal. So I developed methods to actually detect all these digital signals to make for public health intelligence purposes. And a lot of this stuff was highly predictive. My one, I guess, feather in my cap was that I predicted the spread of the Zika virus globally a priori, meaning before it happened. And I was so confident in how well my model performed, I actually had this published in the New York Times. I'm one of the few scientists to ever do it. And really, it's just by using good data and good models and methods and sticking to it. But that aside, because of all the success, I'm promoted to vice president at Eco Health Alliance. So when I'm promoted to vice president, I asked to be added to the PREDICT program, which was a large multi-center, multi-company project between UC Davis, Metabiota, and Metabiota's been in the news with the links to the Ukraine labs and Hunter Biden's investment into those companies, and my organization, Eco Health Alliance. And what we were actually doing is we were going around the planet hunting for coronaviruses and a few other types of viruses, but mainly coronaviruses, and then telling everyone or communicating to everyone that through this process, we were going to predict and prevent pandemics and then also develop medical countermeasures or vaccines based on this work. Well, the program manual for Predict, if when you get back to the screenshot in my hand, it's probably 3 or 4 inches thick. It's a big, thick manual if you actually go read through all the scientific work that's going on, because it's in 30 countries, thousands of projects, multiple people involved, and it's very scientifically dense and broad. So after I'm promoted, I take it upon myself to actually take the time to read all these documents, and I get into it. And then I realize, I'm like, holy crap, this Predict program, it can't do what it's saying. They weren't collecting the right types of data. They weren't collecting the right types of samples at the right sample frequency. The sample sizes were too small. And then when I'm assigned as a country coordinator to both Sudan and Jordan, I receive my budget. This is all heavily tied to the State Department and the diplomatic missions in each state. I'm like, wow, this, what they're asking us to do is just not scientifically not possible. So then I started naturally asking the question, you know, what is this in the back of my mind? But all of this is going on at Equal Health Alliance. I mean, there's a lot of strange things that sort of happen when I start working at Equal Health Alliance. So one, my boss, Dr. Peter Dasta, comes to me and he asked me to build a collaborator report. Collaborator reports are typically documents that scientists send to validate or verify the work that the U.S. government has given them. I'm asked to submit one for what's called the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency. So that in itself was not so weird, but IARPA is part of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. It's like DARPA. It's like the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, but for intelligence.
So, and of course, you're a really smart guy and have all these degrees, but came from the bottom up. If you went and studied some of the deeper history, which you were discovering once you were in there, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're going right to the top, because it's actually ARPA and then DARPA and all these groups that formed after World War II with Operation Paperclip and you name it, that are really the heart of the deep state. From my deep research and interviewing top experts around the world, the real heart of the deep state is a scientific technological elite that Eisenhower warned about. So you were, I guess, unknowingly shooting right to the top.
Oh, absolutely. I was being groomed to be a Dr. Anthony of National Security or Bioterror. And I was aware of that as a PhD student. When they come to you, when you're a PhD student, they say you can be placed anywhere in the U.S. government that you want to work in this field. I mean, I've never heard of that. There's very few students that receive full scholarships plus a six-figure salary to get a PhD. They had to offer that to me to lure me away from my other career prospects, which were in industry with salaries probably, you know, double that, but also not the potential to grow or expand my career within national security. So that was clear to me at a young age. But even then, I was probably naive to a lot of things. And then once you start to, you know, once you see something, you can't unsee it. And that's sort of the journey of, you know, my story, my life going through this. So I'm asked to submit this IARPA collaborative report specifically only to my portfolio work doing this machine learning advanced prediction of disease detection work, which is actually now used by a bunch of the three-letter agencies probably to this day. So that's something that I'm asked to do. Well, what happens when I'm promoted to vice president, I get to start sitting in all the different executive meetings. So there's usually typically at Equal Health Alliance, two or three executive meetings a week. One could be general, where we sort of go through all the different functions of the company, including finance. We could have project specific meetings or other programmatic type meetings. This is all very common for C-suite level type executives. So once I start to see the books though, at Equal Health Alliance, I realized that there was no funding from IARPA for the collaborator report that I submitted. And I found that to be really strange, because typically in a project proposal or a grant or a contract awarded from the government, there would be some strong specific requirement that I would have to report back to IARPA. But my contracts were from the Department of Defense Defense Threat Reduction Agency, which is completely unrelated. So I found that to be odd. So other things I forgot found to be odd. So the Predict program was a big, big farce. So we're running around telling everyone around the world for, you know, $200 million, we're going to predict and forecast pandemics. When I looked at it, my honest assessment was we're just running around the planet collecting coronaviruses. Another strange thing happens when I work at Equal Health Alliance. So my boss, Dr. Peter Dasta, comes to me and he asked me to put together an investment pitch deck to be presented to InQtel. So InQtel is, and I was aware of this before, and I was actually unsure if my boss, Peter Daszak, knew what he was getting into. Like I had my sense of Peter was that he was a great writer. I loved working with him actually when I was a new employee. He has great strategy, a great prose. Sometimes I thought he was too much of an opportunist and didn't understand quite what he was getting into at times, but that could be inaccurate. It's just my perception. So anyways, he comes and asks me to help him put together this IncuTel report. IncuTel is the venture capital firm for the CIA and then also the sort of the DOD at times. Most famously, IncuTel invested into Google Maps Google Earth, which was a huge success. In that proposal, we actually present the using Predict to go out and collect coronavirus samples to then do humanized mice or mouse gain of function work to make medical countermeasures. And this is in 2015 when we assemble this and it's presented. This is also verified by IncuTel's quarterly earnings report to the investors that this presentation takes place. And there's also another, I guess, document or what's a good way of phrasing this, announcement newsletter to their stakeholders that Peter Daszak was presenting this work to them. So it did in fact take place. Whether or not Equal Health received the investment, publicly, to my knowledge, they did not. But IncuTel also invests into companies discreetly and sometimes does not announce it.
Sure, and Dr. Huff, we've got about 35 minutes left or 30 minutes left, and you've got to go. And you're telling an incredible historical story, and it's so important. I know there's a lot more to tell, so maybe at some point you can just boil it down for people. And next time sure. We can have you on for 2 hours if you got it, or we can go 2 hours, but I know you don't have the time because people need to understand. But basically, because I've already read articles about your book, I haven't read the book yet. I've got it ordered. But you start to figure out that really this is like a bioweapons front, or what was it really?
Sure, we can stretch the time a little bit if we need to, and I can talk a little faster.
No, you're doing great. Just want you to know, just continue. Please take your time.
Okay. So Equal Health Alliance, I really believe it was two things. You know, fast forward through this. So the important thing to know is I leave Equal Health Alliance as being a top performing employee, but Peter Daszak and I have a terrible falling out, and actually the CFO dies in the process. You can't make this up. I think it caused the poor guy to have a heart attack. Because I caused so much stress during a meeting. But that aside, I leave Equal Health Alliance, and to me it sort of looks like it's one giant intelligence collection operation. And that also having some kind of tie to the pharmaceutical industry. That's my opinion in 2016 when I leave. I couldn't quite figure it out. You fast forward to COVID's emergence, and the facts as they were portrayed to us, which turned out to be lies from the U.S. government, and all the other documents that I have in my possession, there's two weird things that – there are two things that I'm fairly certain about with Equal Health Alliance. One, it's in this gain-of-function game where they're going out and collecting rare or unique viruses to edit and splice together for gain-of-function to develop medical countermeasures. This is being financed heavily by the national security state, the biomedical security state. Interestingly, Dr. Robert Malone and at Senator Ron Johnson's roundtable this week said the same thing. And I haven't asked Dr. Malone about that yet. We have spoken, but he has a different take on it. And you know, I'd like to know what he thinks. The second side is that I like to explain to people is that the Senate, especially people like Senator Rand Paul, keep accusing NIH of being responsible for this gain of function work. Well, actually, the gain of function work begins under the USAID PREDICT program before NIH has even given them a dime. So these plans happen before NIH is involved.
That's right. It's coming right out of the Defense Department. And if you expand on that, because I've studied it in depth and had a lot of other experts on, correct me if I'm wrong from your own perspective, but basically what they do in biowarfare is they cover up biowarfare labs saying that they are treatment preparation for emerging bio threats or natural emergencies, but really they create the new bioweapon and then they create the so-called vaccine to counter it, which then for big corporations and the military industrial complex is a giant moneymaker and a power center where they can actually create the new pathogens, but also have the cure, which they can also use societally for total control to take control and basically take us off of a carbon-based system, which is in the Operation Lockstep Rockefeller Foundation 2011. And the reason I know all this is you can go read their white papers and the UN talking about disease X in the last 5 years and their predictive programming, getting everybody ready for what's coming and talking about how they're going to use this to take over society, have total digital surveillance, a world vaccine ID system that's then used as the central bank digital currency platform that then implements the global social credit score, the carbon taxes, and the universal basic income. But it's all based on the viral threat bringing out and the acceptance of the QR code world ID.
Well, Alex, it's hard for me to challenge you sometimes because you've been right more times than you've been wrong over the past few years. I used to be a huge skeptic of yours, and I've sort of come to the other side based on your accuracy and, I guess, visionary perception towards the world state, if you want to call it that. The Rockefeller Foundation did fund Eco Health Alliance. The point that I was about to make, though, is that Eco Health Alliance the Chinese did not need $600,000 of U.S. funding to do this gain of function work. And when you step back and you look at it, like, why would the Chinese allow Westerners into their bioweapons laboratory to, presumably snoop around and see what was going on? So how this all starts, this relationship with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, is that in the contract of the understanding the back coronavirus emergence risk proposal, and this is what Rand Paul was talking about, this point I was getting to, you know, they say that, hey, for $600,000, we can do this work with the Chinese. And that's why the Chinese want to do this work with us. Well, no. I mean, it's completely asinine. The Chinese do not need $600,000 of our money. They don't need $5 million of our money. They don't need $10 million of our money because they loaned it to us. So what did the Chinese have to gain here from this? And the one thing that they had to gain and the thing that they wanted was the advanced biotechnology from Dr. Ralph Baric's laboratory at the University of North Carolina. Also the technology from Dr. Ian Lipkin's laboratory at the University of Columbia. So the thing that happens in underneath this PREDICT program and this back coronavirus emergence proposal is that we actually train and give this advanced biotechnology to the Chinese. And without doing that, we wouldn't have SARS-CoV-2. I mean, that's so critical. And so you have to ask yourself, well, why would the U.S. government do this? Why would we not, you know, stamp some kind of export control on this? Because usually the State Department's all over this. Well, I firmly believe that the reason why we are doing this was so that we could actually collect intelligence on the Wuhan Institute of Virology's bioweapons program in exchange for the advanced biotechnology. That I can't figure out for any other reason on the planet why I would do this.
Sure, and we know the Chinese put spies in our universities and research labs as well. And you talked in the earlier interview how you'd also gone and seen what was going on with the Ukrainian labs and all the rest of these. So give us, before you get into now what you know and the points you make in the book exposing this whole thing and these key bullet points that you've sent us that I think are dead on, just a 35,000-foot boil down of why you went public and basically what you've said since, because I think you obviously agree with Senator Paul and others that we've got to stop this, because even if they didn't release this on purpose, which I think the evidence, the motive, the timing, the pre-programming, the media rollouts says they did to you know, bring in this whole new great reset. But regardless, with these labs everywhere, it's only a matter of time before more of this gets out. And it was obviously man-made. We know that from, as you said, the scans of the virus. All these other procedure scientists have said it's conclusive for over 2 years. So, you know, to me, this is the sword of Damocles hanging over all our heads.
Yeah. So the 35,000-foot view here is that there is a lot of old, deep money tied into the scientific model of healthcare, which it has been adopted. The clinical trial system has been completely corrupted. You have other whistleblowers like Brooke Jackson coming out and stating that, you know, she is a witness to the fraud that took place in these clinical trials. If you go look at the mRNA clinical trial reports themselves, they redact the most harmful damning parts out of the clinical trial results, and they won't give it to us from Pfizer. So, I mean, you have to ask yourself what's going on here. Now you have the epidemiology data from the SARS-CoV-2 jabs, which were co-developed with the agent. So that's the other thing I didn't bring up. So I have the proof of that in the book. So the agent and the jabs were co-developed together. And you step back and you look, and it's we've created this huge biomedical industrial complex where the wealthiest people in the country have massive, or the world, I should say, have massive financial incentive to keep on pushing this. And it's really weird when you think about this, because if you look at what are the biggest problems facing the planet right now, the number one problem, in my opinion, is the energy crisis. We've hit peak oil. There's more out there, but it's getting more expensive to extract. And I feel like this gain of function work, this work of pushing out the jabs is also a distraction to serve as a limiting factor on natural resources on the planet. We do have finite natural resources. We could argue about, you know, climate change. I'm not a climate change denier, but on the other hand, I know that if a volcano erupts tomorrow, we could be thrown into a mini ice age. So I'm very, very practical about these things. But what they stand to gain, the people who are in power and control, from these, from the draconian lockdowns, from the restriction of our liberties, from pushing ineffective, harmful drugs onto patients. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me. To show how objective about this, when the first came out, I'm like, well, let's trust the government on the mRNA jabs. And then, you know, 4 months into it, I'm like, well, these don't prevent transmission. It's actually causing new variants to emerge. And it looks like it's harming some people. And then another 4 months after that, I went to completely the other camp. I'm like, these things are completely ineffective. They don't work. They look like they're harming people. Why are we giving these to people? Why are we mandating that people receive this? And it's hard not to go to your point that you just said, that this is some kind of top-down driven control to harm us all. And I think that is a fair point to make, or argument to make, because I can't really make sense of it otherwise.
And then, Doctor, if we add it to the equation, Bill Gates and Melinda, when they first actually started their foundation 30 years ago, it was called the World Population Control Foundation. But about 25 years ago, they changed the name just to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They give each other awards, and they're all calling for depopulation and saying there's too many people. But now they really are funding all these deadly pathogens and then funding shots that don't even make us safe and are linked to all these serious health problems. It's just really interesting when they're calling for death panels and euthanasia and abortion and depopulation, but they really love us, though, and want to give us shots to keep us safe, and they're connected to the actual pathogen and the funding of its creation and then the cover-up of that through mainstream media and big tech. You add those to the equation, Doc, that kind of bumps it up to not a probability, but it looks, if I was a criminologist, it would look to me like that's our prime suspects.
Well, it is quite the fact pattern. I think that's the term they'd use in law. It does seem to add up.
And now Hannity laying out the Twitter scandal, and this thing is just unrattling. This is rattling a lot of cages up there in Washington, D.C., and it's a great Barry Weiss, New York Times, is laying out some of the details for this scandal, doing an excellent job. Here we go with Hannity.
First, our top story tonight, a new batch of Twitter files have officially now been released only moments ago. Journalist Barry Weiss published the latest details uncovering the social media giant's censorship campaign. And what we're learning tonight is downright appalling. Newly unearthed documents now prove that left-wing Twitter employees built blacklists of accounts that they didn't like and would, quote, prevent disfavored tweets from trending and actively limit the visibility of entire accounts or even trending topics, all in secret without informing anybody on Twitter. For example, a prominent doctor from Stanford was secretly placed on the trends blacklist after he argued that COVID lockdowns would harm children. And meanwhile, our very own Dan Bongino, he was put on a search blacklist, limiting who could search for his profile or tweets. He will join us and respond in just a minute. Now, Twitter also blocked Turning Point's founder Charlie Kirk's tweets from being amplified. Apparently, Twitter handled up to 200 of these censorship cases each and every day. But remember, as Weiss points out, Twitter repeatedly denied the use of shadow banning. Twitter was lying. They lied over and over again. I had interviewed at one point Jack Dorsey. He told me specifically, no, we don't shadow ban. Now, we're also learning tonight that Twitter formed a secret group that featured the company's highest-ranking executives that would make decisions in private without much of a paper trail to censor or ban high-profile conservative accounts. Like, for example, a popular account called Libs of TikTok, which was suspended six times in 2022, even though the account did not even violate Twitter's hateful conduct policy. At the same time, the woman who runs Libs of TikTok was doxed on Twitter. In other words, they give out the address of the person. According to Weiss, a tweet with her home address received more than 10,000 likes, and yet Twitter refused to take down that tweet. Now, clearly what Elon Musk said over the weekend was absolutely correct. Twitter was an arm of the Democratic Party and a malicious arm. Take a look.
Clearly, if Twitter is doing one team's bidding before an election, shutting down dissenting voices on a pivotal election, that is the very definition of election interference. I mean, what the hell else would you, of course, it's like, yes, you know, frankly, Twitter was acting like an arm of the Democratic National Committee. It was absurd.
An arm of the Democratic National Committee shutting down dissenting voices is, by its very definition, election interference. Now, it's not only Twitter. Almost every big tech company acted as an arm of the Democratic Party and interfered in our elections. And tonight, I call on all of them, Apple, Google, Facebook, all of you follow Elon Musk's lead. You need to be transparent. And by the way, will the media mob finally take note? Don't hold your breath, because as Elon Musk suggested on Saturday, many in the media mob, they are totally, completely compromised, my words, his word, complicit. Take a listen.
Well, I think those people should be looking in the mirror and wondering why they were deceptive. Why did they deceive the American public? And instead of trying to redirect blame to Matt Taibbi, they need to be accepting some responsibility themselves for not being truthful to the American public.
Not being truthful to the American public. Now, obviously, big tech and big media, they have been acting as an arm of the Democratic Party for quite some time. That's not news to this audience, but we may never know the full extent of their efforts. Now, because get this, now Elon Musk is suggesting that some files may have been deleted or removed. Now, this came out after Musk discovered that the controversial ex-FBI Russiagate lawyer James Baker was personally reviewing and approving the initial batch of Twitter files that were put out by Matt Taibbi. And Baker was still serving as a top lawyer for Twitter until Musk fired him earlier this week. This is a huge story. Now, instead of voicing concern about Twitter's collusion with the DNC and potentially the federal government, many so-called journalists are now more worried that Musk installed beds at Twitter's headquarters in case employees were tired, working a lot of overtime, so they'd have a place to get a few hours sleep. San Francisco, what's their reaction to being nice to your employees? Oh, let's open up an investigation on Elon Musk. Now, that prompted this response from Elon Musk. So the city of San Francisco attacks companies providing beds for tired employees instead of making sure kids are safe from fentanyl. Where are your priorities, Mayor London Breed? But the madness doesn't stop there. Now, the compromised congenital liar, Adam Schiff, he's so deeply troubled by Elon Musk and his push for free speech that he's now just flat-out lying about hate speech on the platform, citing zero evidence at all whatsoever. Schiff tweeted earlier today, quote, against slurs against black people have tripled on Elon Musk's Twitter, and claimed that slurs against women are on the rise, too. Musk immediately poured cold water on those claims, replying, quote, false. Hate speech impressions are actually down by a third for Twitter now versus prior to the acquisition. Meanwhile, the White House press secretary asked about the Twitter files and the Democratic push for censorship earlier today by our own Peter Ducey. All she wanted to do was not answer the question and say bye-bye.
You've said a few times that you really can't talk about communications between the Biden campaign and Twitter. Who is telling you that that's off limits?
I've already had that conversation with you, with your colleague, I believe, yesterday. I've already addressed this multiple times this week, so I don't have anything more to add. Again, we've litigated this all week. Don't have anything to add.
So not a campaign.
I'm going to the back. Go ahead.
All right, so let me get this straight. So we know now, according to Elon Musk, that the Democratic Party, the FBI, also involved with weekly meetings warning Twitter that there may be false information about Hunter Biden coming out. You got to be on the lookout for this before the election. Meanwhile, they had Hunter Biden's laptop a full 11 months before the 2020 presidential election. Then Elon Musk says, yeah, suppressing information is by definition election interference, but the White House doesn't want to talk about it because they benefited from it.
Wrapping this whole Twitter thing up is Bongino, and he was interviewed this morning, so this is really fresh information, and he bombasted his view onto the morning program. But he's a really stand-up guy. He's a man, that's for sure. But here we go with Bongino.
We're back with the Fox News Alert, part three of the Twitter files, revealing executives met with the FBI and DHS and DNI on a weekly basis around the 2020 election.
Weekly basis. In a series of tweets, Matt Taibbi writes, policy director Nick Pickles is asked if the marketing department should say Twitter detects misinformation through human review and partnerships with outside experts.
Yeah, so Pickles told them to say partnerships. Not sure we'd describe the FBI and DHS as experts, reads the quote.
Sounds right.
Whatever it is, they're looking for some way to characterize their relationship with law enforcement. And Unfiltered's Dan Bongino is a great place to start in characterizing that relationship. As we learned this week, Dan, you were one of the people placed on Twitter's blacklist to their search engine. Good morning, Dan. How would you characterize that relationship?
Listen, this is only the biggest First Amendment scandal of my lifetime. I just turned 48 not that long ago. I've never seen, and here's the crazy thing, guys. It's so easy to explain that it's hilarious watching liberal media activists, you know, wet their diapers trying to defend this. First, remember the story over the Twitter government collusion to suppress people like me and shadow ban me? The first story was, well, listen, it's a private company. They can do what they want. There's really no government involvement. And then we found out that there was government involvement, that the FBI may have been involved. And then we were confirmed that the FBI was involved. And then they were like, well, the FBI was just giving general warnings to tech companies. And then it turned out that it was the FBI and the DNI and the DHS and potentially the CDC and others. And then they were like, okay, it was just a lot of general warnings from the government. And then, sorry, one more, guys. Then the story morphed again. The Yoel Roth Twitter executive sworn statement to the FEC came out where he admitted that it wasn't a general warning, but that these entities had warned specifically about the Hunter Biden story. And now all of a sudden they're like, well, screw it, we're just commies. Let's just admit it and cut the BS. I mean, really, this is the, guys, can anyone on the couch, I know you're all strong, liberty-loving patriots, can anyone explain to me how the FBI, the DNI, and the DHS, meeting with a private company and winking and nodding, suggesting they restrict people's free speech, can you please explain to me how that's not a violation of the First Amendment? I'm all ears, man. It's unbelievable we're even having this debate.
Well, but Dan, the media is ignoring it. You know, outside of us, we're covering it, but the media is ignoring it. You know, as we learn more, how deep do you think this goes, Dan?
Well, listen, this is the next shoe to drop here. So on my show tonight, I have an unfiltered about, it was supposed to be an 8-minute monologue. I think Pete may have heard some of it. I've interviewed Pete tonight as well. He's always awesome. But it was supposed to be 8. It turned into like a 13-minute monologue. It's completely unscripted. And it really screwed up my whole show because we almost had to cancel some guests, not Pete. But I produced the receipts and the facts tonight. That it's not just that they colluded with the government to restrict free speech. We know that. Media imbeciles, we're not arguing about that. Just sit in the corner and shut up. We get all that. You guys are just useless anyway. We'll take this from here. The next shoe to drop is, were these tech companies colluding with each other? And I'll tell you why I bring this up. And I produced the receipts tonight on my show. Mm-hmm. You know, I was attacked at the. But I don't want to be dramatic. I was confronted by a lot of these tech companies, let's say, all around the same time on my podcast and everywhere else. And they all seem to have the same message. Now, I can't prove they were colluding with each other, but I'll show you tonight how Google, how YouTube, which is part of Google, Facebook and Twitter, all in this same time period, all came after little old Dan Bongino from Queens. YouTube banned me for saying that cloth masks don't stop the spread of COVID, which now, by the way, is scientific fact. Google ads wiped my website off their network. This is all around the same time Twitter suspended me after January 6th for simply retweeting Trump's statement.
Yeah.
And then Facebook says at the same time, oh, we're going to start crushing political content. And who is it going to affect? I even show you the news media piece. It says Ben Shapiro and Dan Bongino, because we have the biggest Facebook pages in the conservative space. Were they colluding with each other? That's the next shoe to drop. I think they were.
So, go ahead. If I could, you know, I was thinking about Dan's question to us, and I wanted to engage.
I was too.
Of how they say it's not a First Amendment violation, like that question, Dan. And you know, like you, Dan, I love debating, right? So that means I go seek out the other side. How are they saying it? Increasingly in this story, how are they spinning it? I'll tell you what they're saying, Dan. Other than it's a nothing burger, there's the way they're saying this isn't a First Amendment violation is they're saying, well, the FBI can make recommendations to private companies. They can make recommendations on what they believe is disinformation. And then I think we move to the next step, which is, but if all of the recommendations flow in one direction, what does that tell us about our national intelligence apparatus, right? FBI, DHS. DNI, what does that tell us about those organizations, which we increasingly focus on and need to, and their point of view when it comes to someone like you, somebody like me, somebody Pete or Lisa, and our points of view?
You're a lawyer, so you'll get this probably better than most. I'm not, but I'm intimately familiar with how the law works, having spent my career in law enforcement. The law, and the reason we have judges, because as you know, Will, the law is a lot of gray area.
Right.
So, yes, they could technically say, oh, we just winked and nodded at Twitter and said, hey, this tweet Dan Bongino put out there about masks, you know, this could be classified as misinformation. You know, be a real shame if your place burned down if you didn't do anything about it, right?
Right.
And then the FBI can sit back and say, we didn't demand anything and play kind of a euphemisms game. But, Will, as an attorney, you know this. No judge is going to take that seriously. There's an implied force mechanism with government that doesn't exist when a private entity does that. The government is the only entity in the United States, in our country, that has the power to take your life and your freedom. We don't have mercenaries. We don't have a private police that are deputized by the government. You may have some kind of police powers, but the government sanctions that all the time. So when the FBI makes a recommendation, it's not a recommendation. It's an implied, you better do this or else. And any serious judge knows that. You know, the liberals
by the way, Dan, I'm sorry.
Really,
this was happening at the same time, by the way. Democratic politicians were threatening big tech. You remember that?
Openly.
Democratic politicians were threatening big tech while the law enforcement arms were making suggestions.
Well, I was an investor, early investor in Parler. AOC literally tweeted out to Amazon about their cloud, which Parler was on. Hey, Amazon, what are you guys going to do about Parler? I mean, are you now again to the libs? I know you're not that bright, but let's reverse this a bit. They're not. They don't get
it
unless it kicks them in the teeth. Imagine you had said something like to the pro-abortion crowd on the left that the FBI went into a say pro-life group and said, hey, guys, you know, we're not recommending you block an abortion clinic, but, you know, if you did it, we may not do anything about it. So, you know, if you guys go and block, they would lose their minds. They would lose their minds.
It all always goes in the direction of hurting Republicans.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
It's
Democrats in Washington, D.C. with a lot of power, winking and nodding at Democrats in San Francisco with a lot of power, all flowing in one particular direction. And they never counted on any of us knowing because it's an elite government agency and a Silicon Valley company that wasn't supposed to be bought by Elon Musk. Instead, we learned that guys like you were targeted. Dan, real quick, on your show tonight, what do you got?
I got Pete Hegseth, Charlie Kirk, Byron Donalds,